Seeing that my plan was having the desired effect, I kept pressing. And when you shot Matthew and Thomas and Clara, I suppose you didn't want to do that either. Your finger slipped on the trigger, or they asked you to shoot them. The doctor was by now staring at me, perplexed and alarmed. Stevie, what are you— I ignored him. What about that? I went on harshly. How did you do the right thing there? Her breath now coming in quick heaves, Libby shouted, "It was better for them. Do you think I wanted to shoot them? It was better for them to be finished with this world." "Yeah," I shouted back at her, "better so you could take their money and go off with your boyfriend, the preacher." "Be quiet, goddamn you children. Can't any of you ever just be quiet?" Swallowing hard, Libby tried, without much success, to get a firmer grip on herself. "You know what this leads to. I've warned you, and now I have to show you." Looking at me, all of a sudden, the way she must have figured have looked at all the children she'd killed just before the act, she raised her pistol into the air and brought it down on the doctor's head, causing him to tumble to the ground, still conscious but bleeding from a cut above his temple. Brutal as the deed was, it gave me all the time I needed. When Libby yanked the doctor back up by his collar, she turned again to find me holding Miss Howard's Colt with both hands and training its barrel on her. "Okay," I said, my own heart racing. "Now, you want to start killing people? You go ahead. But I promise you'll be the second one to go." Chapter 56. She was looking at me with the same expression what had been on her face when Mr. Picton had revealed that we knew about the grave behind her family's barn. Surprise and shock. Again, I got the feeling that she hadn't been in such positions many times in her life, and that fact, I knew, might lead her to do some unpredictable things. But I had my own little dose of unpredictability up my sleeve, one what I was getting set to administer. Her eyes dancing in fear and anger, Libby's mouth first tightened up, then cracked open long enough for her to say, "I'll kill him. I swear I will." I nodded to her. "I know," I said. "Question is, do you want to go too?" "What choice do I have?" the woman shouted back. "Damn you, you're just like the others. You don't leave me any choice." "I'll give you a choice," I said. "You let the doctor walk over here, then you run. We won't follow." The doctor, still reeling a little from the blow to the head he'd taken, looked as confused as Libby Hatch. "Stevie, what are you saying?" Once again, I paid him no mind. "Well," I said, keeping my eyes on Libby. She did a little dance in her head with the idea, looking tempted. Then I got some unexpected help when Mr. Roosevelt's voice boomed up from down in the street. "They're retreating. Lieutenant Kimball, detail some of your men. I want Knox taken into custody." I let myself have a little smile just then. "You hear that?" I said, nodding toward the front edge of the roof. "Your pal Goo-Goo's beating it out of here. So what's it gonna be? You gonna play smart and go with him?" "How do I know you won't follow me?" Libby asked. The next part of my performance had to be the best. I took a deep breath, kept my eyes on hers, then said, "You can take this gun. It's the only one we got." The doctor wasn't so dazed as not to understand that. "No," he said, "Stevie, do not—" But Libby cut him off. "You slide it over here first." I shook my head. "You let go. Let him take two steps clear, then I will." "Stevie," the doctor insisted, "you can't trust—" He stopped as Libby jammed the barrel of her pistol hard against his head. "Oh, yes, that's right, isn't it, doctor? You can't trust Libby. You can't trust the woman. She'll break her word. She'll shoot you in the back. After all, she killed her own children, didn't she? And all those others, too. How can you possibly trust someone who could do all that? Well, let me tell you, Dr. Kreitzler." Moving the barrel of the gun a couple of inches away from the doctor's skull, Libby swayed a bit, like things were really starting to get to her. "Let me tell you," she said again, her voice getting softer and what you might call detached. "I did everything for those children. My own, I went through the agony of bearing. The others, I went through the long, sleepless, endless hours of caring for, feeding, cleaning, changing, and for what? For what, doctor? They never stopped crying. They never stopped getting sick. They never stopped needing." With a free hand, Libby clutched at her hair as her face and voice filled with truly desperate anger and sorrow. "Needing, always needing. It never stopped. I did everything I could, everything, but it never stopped. It should have been enough. It was all I could do. It should have been enough, but it never was. It never was, and so, can't you see, they were better off after I—" Suddenly she glanced down at the roof and mumbled, "They didn't need anything then." Shaking herself hard, Libby looked back up, the gold light of the clever killer suddenly back in her eyes. "All right, boy. He takes two steps, then you slide the gun over. I nodded. That's the deal. The doctor tried one more time to stop me. Stevie, do not do this. Go on, doctor. Libby almost chuckled in her most frightening voice. Take your two steps. As the doctor started to move, Libby kept her gun trained squarely on his head. When he'd gotten what I figured was far enough from her, I leaned down and placed Miss Howard's revolver on the tar. Stevie, the doctor tried again, but I just looked up at him, hoping that he could read the message in my eyes. It took him a second or two, but he did eventually get it. Then he closed his mouth and nodded. All right, Libby said. Slide it over. I did as I was told. The Colt came to a stop just at Libby's feet, and she quickly leaned over to pick it up. Then she stood again, without either turning to run or lowering her own weapon. Actually, doctor, she said, with one of her most cunning, seductive little smiles, you were quite right. Her revolver clicked loudly as she pulled back the hammer. I've no intention of allowing any of you. She never finished the sentence. A small hissing sound cut through the night air, and I jumped over to grab the doctor's legs and pull him down to the roof. A shot went off, but it struck only an iron furnace chimney on the house next door with a loud clang. Then both the doctor and I looked up. Libby's smile was gone now, but her eyes were still open, and she was still clutching her smoking gun. The better part of a small, crude arrow was sticking out of the side of her neck, and I knew that, though she was still on her feet, there was a good chance that she was already dead. The strychnine could have killed her before the muscles of her legs had a chance to give way. After another second or two, she did collapse, first to her knees, and then, after another pause, over onto her side. The doctor and I ran over to her immediately, myself taking care to quickly pry the pistol from her hand. For his part, the doctor lifted her head and examined her eyes, then felt her neck for a pulse. He must have sensed something, being as he said, Elspeth? Elspeth Franklin? As the last air left her lungs, Libby managed to form the words, Always needing. Then she was gone. And the doctor reached out to close the golden eyes for the last time. I don't know how long the pair of us crouched there looking at her, but I do know that what finally brought us around was the sound of knocking on the underside of the hatchway cover. Sarah, it was Mr. Moore's voice, shouting up from below the closed entryway. Stevie, Kreitzler, what the hell happened? Are you all right? Both the hatchway cover and Miss Howard's body jumped a bit as Mr. Moore tried to get up onto the roof. And with the bumping movement, Miss Howard began to come around, first groaning and then, as her eyes opened, rolling over and falling onto the roof with a small grunt. Sarah, the doctor said urgently. He lay Libby Hatch out on the roof quickly, then ran over to where Miss Howard lay, just as Mr. Moore leaped up and out of the hatchway. Good Christ, he said, taking in the scene. What the hell happened here? Ignoring the question, the doctor pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket and lifted Miss Howard's shoulders up onto his knee. Then he began to wipe at and examine the spot on her head where she'd been hit, soon satisfying himself that it wasn't a serious wound. Gently rubbing and patting her cheeks with his hand, he finally got her to focus on him. Doctor, she breathed, looking around. She tried dizzily to make a move. What happened? Where? The doctor held her still. Be calm, Sarah, he said with a smile, brushing her hair out of her face as Mr. Moore and I gathered round. It's over. At least this part of it is. Then he turned her so that, without moving her head much, she could see Libby Hatch's body. She's dead? Miss Howard said, and in spite of the fact that she was still a little groggy, I could hear a faint touch of sadness in her voice. Yes, the doctor answered, gently sensing, I think, how she felt. Miss Howard watched the body for a few more seconds. Then, in a quick sort of spasm, she made a noise what seemed like a combination of a gasp and a lone, deep sob. She turned her head back toward us, and I could see a tear on her cheek. I'm sorry, she whispered, wiping the tear away as fast as she was able. I know I shouldn't. The doctor quieted her with a little shushing sound and rubbed her cheek softly again. Don't apologize. Someone should shed a tear at this moment. He paused, then looked over at Libby Hatch. but I confess that I cannot. I cannot. Miss Howard suddenly looked puzzled. But, she said, trying to sit up, who... That's what I'd like to know, Mr. Moore said, glancing at the doctor and me. Take a look at her neck, I told him. Making his way carefully across the roof, as if Libby might still jump up and have at him, Mr. Moore carefully examined the body, then nodded. Oh! So it was the Aborigine, after all. He retrieved Miss Howard's colt, then glanced at the rooftops around us. Where is he? He asked. Don't know, I said with a shrug. Pretty far by now. And still moving, I hope. Well, we'd better have that arrow, Mr. Moore answered, cautiously reaching down to remove the thing from Libby's neck. I wouldn't want to try to explain it to Roosevelt, he added, tossing the missile over the edge of the roof into the backyard. And I'm sure the wound will be mysterious enough to confound whatever fool coroner the police engage. Walking back across the roof, quickly, he gave me a questioning but approving look. Did the two of you plan this, Stevie?
I wouldn't exactly say we planned it, I answered.
The doctor looked up at me, uncertainty and pride showing together in a slight smile. Your gambling instincts seem to be intractable, Stevie.
It wasn't a gamble, I said. Not if you knew him like I did.
Miss Howard, her head clearing, reached up to touch the side of the doctor's slightly bloodied face.
You're hurt, she said.
That too is thanks to our young friend, the doctor replied, nodding my way, but it's not serious. All part of Stevie's plan, it seems.
Hey, wait a minute, I protested quickly. I didn't know she'd actually smack you.
The doctor already had a hand up. It was well worth it. An appropriate punishment for ever doubting your judgment in such matters. Then his black eyes gave me a more serious look. I mean it, Stevie. It was a brilliant bit of work. As if to punctuate the remark, Mr. Moore gave my head a rub, and Miss Howard smiled at me, all of which, of course, was just the sort of attention what's always made my skin crawl. Fortunately, I quickly thought of a way to change the topic. What about Anna? I asked, looking up at Mr. Moore. His face suddenly went straight. Oh, God, he said, with what sounded like dread. Yes, Anna. He looked to the doctor and Miss Howard. Can you two make it downstairs? Miss Howard began to struggle to her feet.
I think so, she said, finally standing. Why, John, what is it?
Mr. Moore, still looking what you might call inscrutable, just shook his head. I could tell you, he said, but you'd never believe it. Chapter 57. By the time we got back down to the first floor of the building, the action out on the street seemed to have calmed down quite a bit, and from the cheering sounds being made by our sailors, it seemed like they truly had come away from the encounter winners. As we passed by the front door, Marcus came in through it, confirming that the dusters had fled the scene, a result what he too seemed to find very heartening. It was up to me to be the spoil sport, by informing everybody that if in fact the dusters had disappeared for the moment, they'd likely be back. Soon, in greater numbers, they'd probably call in more auxiliaries, and better armed, which meant guns. What makes you think that, Stevie? Mr. Moore said, poking his head outside the door and looking around. Those Navy boys gave them one hell of a black eye. I wouldn't think they'd be any too anxious to come back for more. They have to, I answered. We took them on right in the middle of their own territory. They let this stand and they'll lose that territory to every gang what borders them. It's a sign of weakness, and they can't afford it. Stevie's logic once again is sound, the doctor said. Let's not forget that he knows this world far better than the rest of us. Marcus, I suggest you find Roosevelt. Tell him to forget about arresting Knox or anyone else, and simply detach a group of men to retrieve Libby Hatch's body from the roof. Then we shall return to the boats. Nodding in agreement, Marcus turned to Mr. Moore. Are you taking them down, John? Mr. Moore just nodded back, and then Marcus turned to me. It was the garden that gave me the tip, Stevie. Remember the way it seemed so untended? And how unused you said those tools downstairs looked? Puzzled, I furrowed my eyebrows at him. Yeah? Well, the detective sergeant said, heading back out into the street, there was a reason. Further bewildered by that last comment, the doctor, Miss Howard, and I followed Mr. Moore to the basement door, then down into the dusty cave below. The one electrical bulb was lit, showing things pretty well the way I'd left them the night I'd been there. In other words, there was no sign of any secret doorway having been forced open, a fact which surprised not only me, but the doctor and Miss Howard, too.
"Moore," the doctor said, "I thought you intimated—"
Mr. Moore held up a hand. "We closed it again to give you the full effect," he said, going past a rack of preserves to the collection of old rusty garden tools. "We did everything we could to try to move this thing manually," he said, indicating the rack. "And you might actually have moved it, Stevie, if you'd picked something other than that old hoe to try to wedge behind it."
"What do you mean?" I said, not getting the hint.
Mr. Moore pointed at the two tallest of the tools, a shovel and an iron rake, which stood side by side. "Open," he said, indicating the shovel, "and close," at which point he touched the rake.
"Moore, we've no time for games," the doctor said. "What the devil are you talking about?"
By way of an answer, Mr. Moore just held up a finger, then grabbed hold of the shovel's handle. The tool didn't come away from its resting spot at his touch. Instead, it pivoted at a point on the floor to which it was, it seemed, anchored. As Mr. Moore lowered the thing on that pivot, lo and behold, the rack of preserves began to move as if by itself. It swung away from the brick dividing wall by the furnace and revealed a 3-foot square hole leading down through the stone floor and into the ground below the building.
"Oh, my God,"
Miss Howard whispered, stepping forward toward the hole. The doctor and I followed, shocked past speech.
"Just big enough for an average adult to negotiate," Mr. Moore said, picking up one of the Isaacson's portable torches what lay nearby. "As is the entire passageway."
"Passageway?" the doctor echoed.
"Come on," Mr. Moore said, taking a few steps down onto an iron ladder what was fixed to the side of a deep shaftway what led downwards from the hole. "I'll show you." With that, he disappeared below ground, while the rest of us looked nervously to each other.
"How come I got no big desire to go down there?" I said quietly.
"You've been through an awful lot, Stevie," Miss Howard answered, putting a hand to my arm, "and what's down there may not be too pleasant."
"It would be completely understandable if you wished to wait here," the doctor agreed.
I shook my head. "It ain't that. I want to see it, but—" Trying to shake off my severe jitters, I stepped down onto the ladder.
"Ah, hell," I said. "How much worse can this thing get?"
Moving carefully, I followed Mr. Moore's torch, which appeared to come to a stop about 15 feet down.
"Wait for 1 second before you come all the way down, Stevie," he called to me, "so I can get into the side passage. Each of you will have to do the same."
"The side passage?" I repeated.
"You'll see when you get here."
And I did. At the base of the shaftway, the walls of which were rough concrete, was an opening into a narrow tunnel what ran sideways. The thing was just high enough for a person to crouch in so as you could kind of scurry along without actually crawling. Mr. Moore guided me into this space when I got down, then did the same for Miss Howard and the doctor when they arrived. After that, he turned his torch in what I calculated to be the direction of the backyard, revealing that the passageway, what was also concrete, went on for another 40 feet. There was a dank smell to it, but it wasn't nearly as stifling as it should have been.
"Is that a draft?" Miss Howard asked, licking her finger and holding it up.
"It becomes almost a breeze," Mr. Moore answered, his face lit up like a jack-o'-lantern by the light of the torch, "once you get to the other end."
"But what produces it?" the doctor asked.
"All part of the surprise, Laszlo," Mr. Moore answered, starting down the tunnel toward a small glow of light that filled its far end. He cupped his free hand in front of his mouth. "Lucius, you still there?"
"Yes, John," came Lucius's whispering reply, "but keep your voice down, damn it."
We kept scuffling along, crooked over like coal miners, and as we went, a thought occurred to me.
"I don't hear any baby crying," I said grimly.
"No," Mr. Moore answered in that same inscrutable tone of voice he'd used on the roof, "you don't."
In another few seconds we'd reached the end of the passageway and arrived at a small wooden doorway. It was cracked open just a bit, and the crack was producing the light we'd seen from the other end. It appeared that this entranceway led into yet another chamber, and as we collected ourselves to go on in, my nerves fluttered worse than ever.
Pictures of torture chambers and castle dungeons began to flash through my head. Racks, iron maidens, red-hot irons, exposure to filth and rats. Who knew what Libby Hatch had used to try to get the unruly kids she kidnapped to behave? I began to wonder if maybe I shouldn't have taken the chance to just wait up top, but once again, I swallowed all such hesitations. "All right," Mr. Moore said. "Everyone's set." Nobody said they were, but nobody said they weren't either, and Mr. Moore took that as a sign to proceed. "Then follow me." He swung the little door open, and we entered the room. The first thing you noticed about the space was light, bright light, produced not by bare electrical bulbs, but by very pleasant little lamps, what sat on a pair of wooden night tables and a small chest of drawers, what was painted a gentle pink. The walls had been covered with patterned paper, what showed little pictures of smiling baby animals against a white ground. The paper reflected the light of the lamps and made the glare, especially as you came out of the dark passageway, all the harsher. As Mr. Moore had said, the draft we'd felt became a kind of breeze once we'd entered the room, one what was actually very refreshing. It was produced, he told us, by electrical fans inside smaller ventilation shafts what led up to the backyard and drew air down from there. On the wall opposite the chest of drawers was a handsome crib with a white lace canopy over its top. In a third wall, a window frame had been installed, complete with glass, and behind this some talented person had painted a quiet country scene, one what resembled the rolling hills and open pasturelands of Saratoga County. There was a handmade carpet on the floor and a fine oak rocking chair in one corner, and all over the place there were mountains of toys, everything from an expensive musical box to stuffed animals to building blocks. In fact, if you'd been above ground, it would have been a first-class nursery. "Holy Christ," I mumbled, too shocked to offer anything else by way of an opinion. My dumbfoundedness was only increased when I looked into the corner and at the rocking chair. In it was sitting Detective Sergeant Lucius, gently rocking back and forth as he held a content Anna Linares in his arms. Faced with three stunned faces, the Detective Sergeant blushed a bit. "I had to change her diaper to get her to stop crying," he said with some embarrassment, "but it was all right. I've had a lot of practice with my sister's children." "Apparently," the doctor said, approaching the pair and bending down to put a finger to Anna's face, "you've done very well, Detective Sergeant. My compliments." Miss Howard and I gathered around. "She's all right, then?" Miss Howard asked. "Well, she's undernourished, certainly," Lucius answered, "and slightly colicky, but that was to be expected, I suppose." His eyes suddenly lit up with interest. "What about Mrs. Hatch?" "The Aborigine got her," Mr. Moore announced. "The Navy boys are fetching her body now, and according to our resident gangland expert here," he pointed my way, "we've all got to get moving before the dusters come back looking for even bigger trouble." "Yes," Lucius replied nervously as he carefully stood up with the baby. "I think that would be a wise idea. Sarah, would you like to—" Miss Howard, though, made no move to take the child. Instead, she just smiled, a little deviously. "You're doing extremely well, Lucius, and I've had a rather nasty bump on the head, I'm afraid. I might lose my balance on the way out." "Do you mind taking her, Detective Sergeant?" the doctor asked, roaming around the room and trying, it seemed to me, to burn the startling image of it into his mind before we had to leave. "No, no," Lucius answered, still rocking the baby. Then he turned a warning look on the rest of us. "I just don't want to hear about it for years to come, that's all." Taking a few steps forward, he stood by the doctor and gazed around the room with him. "A little difficult to accept, isn't it?" The doctor only shrugged. "Is it? I wonder." "What do you mean, Laszlo?" Mr. Moore said, picking up a little stuffed dog and rubbing it against his nose. "Given who we've been dealing with, I would have expected something a lot more austere, and that's putting it euphemistically." "That was only one side of her, John," Miss Howard said, running a finger over the grinning baby animals of the room's wallpaper. "Indeed, Sarah," the doctor agreed quietly. "Well," I offered, finally getting over my own amazement, "one thing's for sure anyway." "Stevie?" the doctor asked, looking my way. I shrugged. "She finally got some privacy. Had to dig halfway to China to get it, but—" The doctor nodded. "True." He glanced at Anna Linares.
And yet, even here, sealed off from the world, she could not. The doctor's words trailed off as he stared into the baby's enormous round eyes, which were almost as dark as his own. "You," he said, forgetting his last thought and putting a hand to Anna's chin, making her smile that big game grin what we'd come to know so well from the photograph her mother had given us. "You have been a very difficult young lady to find, Señorita Linares. But thank God you're safe. Thank God."
"Well," Mr. Moore said, "she won't stay safe if we all don't get out of here. So get a good last look, Chrysler. Something tells me we won't be coming back into Duster territory for quite a while." With that, we all started back into the passageway, leaving the doctor behind for a few seconds to give him just a little more time to mentally memorize the strange hideaway what had been Libby Hatch's obsession, and what was now, being as she was dead, the only remaining blueprint he had to the workings of her tangled mind. Back upstairs, we found that Mr. Roosevelt and Lieutenant Kimball had come into the house along with Marcus. The rest of the Navy boys were gathered around the steps outside, and a couple of them were carrying a folding stretcher, what they must have fetched from one of the torpedo boats. Strapped to the stretcher was Libby Hatch's body, draped in a bedsheet. The general mood of the bunch seemed to have changed from celebration to concern. Apparently, a couple of sailors had seen a few dusters making moves, what indicated that the gang was in fact preparing a new attack. So we got out onto the sidewalk quickly, the sailors forming a circle around Lucius, who still had the baby, and the men, what were carrying the stretcher. Then at double time we began to trot back toward the river. As we went, I fell in beside Cyrus. His clothes were a little rearranged, but otherwise he looked hale, hearty, and very satisfied. "Ain't many people what come away from locking horns with Ding Dong looking as healthy as you do, Cyrus," I said, smiling up to him. He shrugged, though he couldn't help but grin a bit himself.
"That's because there aren't many people who get him in a fair fight," he answered.
"So I'm guessing you came out on top?"
Glancing up ahead to the construction site of the Bell Laboratories, what was now on our left, Cyrus answered,
"I'll let you be the judge of that."
He nodded in the direction of a big pile of bricks. Propped up against them was Ding Dong, his face a patchwork of bruises and his arms and legs sticking out at what you might call angles.
"Jesus," I breathed, whistling low. "Is he alive?"
"Oh, he's alive, all right," Cyrus answered, "though in the morning he may wish he wasn't."
I nodded grimly at that, feeling some deep sense of justice. And as we trotted on toward the river, Cyrus looked down at me meaningfully.
"You know I always thought she was trouble, Stevie," he said. "I won't deny that now, but she did right by you, by us, and by the baby in the end. So I guess I was wrong."
I gave him a look what I hoped was as full of thanks as I felt.
"You weren't wrong," I said. "Trouble she was. But she was other things, too."
Cyrus nodded.
"That's so."
The general mood of our little army improved considerably once we got back across West Street and started to move at the same double-time pace south on the waterfront. As the huge black outline of the White Star Line pier began to grow bigger, you could start to feel the cloud of the anxiousness lifting from over us, but it was up to Mr. Roosevelt to give the official signal that it was okay to breathe easier.
"Well then, Doctor," he boomed as we trotted past Perry Street, "it would seem that we've enjoyed a victory."
"I shall reserve final judgment until we are safely cast off," the doctor answered cautiously, still watching the streets around us. "But the preliminary results are encouraging."
Mr. Roosevelt roared with laughter.
"By God, Chrysler, if I ever met a man more apt to see the dark side of a situation, I'm not aware of it. True, we didn't take that infernal scoundrel Knox into custody, but we delivered a message that those swine won't soon forget, and at the cost of only a few bruises to our own men. Enjoy the moment, Doctor. Savor it."
"Our casualties were no greater than bruises?" the doctor asked, still not ready to give in to celebrating.
"Well, all right, two men's arms were broken," Mr. Roosevelt conceded, "and another suffered a fractured jaw, but I assure you the culprits were paid back with interest. So I'll have none of your melancholy, my friend, none at all.
You must learn to enjoy your triumphs."
The doctor did smile at that, though I think it was as much out of amusement at his old friend's incorrigible attitude as any real joy over what had just taken place at No. 39 Bethune Street. Oh, he was happy we'd rescued little Anna, I didn't doubt that. But the final secrets of why all the horrors we'd experienced had been necessary in the first place were now lying forever hidden on the stretcher what the two sailors next to Detective Sergeant Lucius were carrying. Legally prevented for the time being from using the operating theater at his institute, the doctor had no place to perform a post-mortem on Libby Hatch's brain to see if it had been abnormal in some way. And even if he hadn't been so restricted, the detective sergeants couldn't exactly deliver a body with a dissected head to their superiors. Coming on top of Libby's death, these considerations would, I knew, always prevent the doctor from seeing our experience as a triumph, just as Cat's death would always make the memory of the adventure especially bittersweet for me. We got to the torpedo boats without any trouble and got Libby Hatch's body stowed aboard the closest of them. The Isaacsons planned to accompany said boat to a police pier down by the battery where they'd be able to close the case what their department had been so unwilling to open in the first place. Miss Howard, in the meantime, would take Anna Linares in the lead boat with the rest of us, first back to the Brooklyn Navy Yard and from there on to the doctor's house. Once safely home, Miss Howard would telephone the Senora, who since that afternoon had been waiting for a message at the French consulate where she'd gone to hide from her husband. Her head now completely clear, Miss Howard got into the lead torpedo boat without any trouble, and waited for Lucius to bring Anna down the ladder to her. But not unpredictably, Mr. Roosevelt stepped in to do the honors. "You get back to your boat, Detective Sergeant," he said, taking the baby. "I've had quite a lot of experience with such little bundles as this one, and you may rest assured that I shall get her safely aboard." Cradling Anna in one arm, Mr. Roosevelt then made his way nimbly down the long ladder from the pier to our boat. He moved with much greater ease, considering his cargo, than any of us could have done, and I remembered, watching him, that he had 5 young kids of his own, who he must have toted around in similar, if not identical, situations many times. Once he'd gotten aboard and was handing the baby over to Miss Howard, Mr. Roosevelt took a moment to actually look at Anna's appealing little features. "Why," he said in a soft way, what wasn't at all like his usual manner, "what an extraordinary face. Look at her eyes, doctor." "Yes," the doctor said as he jumped down from the ladder into the boat. "I've seen them, Roosevelt. A beautiful child." Letting one of his big fingers play around little Anna's face, Mr. Roosevelt offhandedly asked, "Whose is she?" Mr. Moore, Miss Howard, the doctor, Cyrus, and I all froze. But fortunately, Mr. Roosevelt was too preoccupied to notice. "Whose?" the doctor repeated smoothly as our boat's engines rumbled to life and our crew began to cast off. "Does it matter, Roosevelt?" "Matter?" Mr. Roosevelt answered with a shrug. "I don't know that it matters, but after what we've been through, I should like to meet the parents." He grinned wide as Anna reached out to grasp hold of his finger. "And tell them how lucky they are to have engaged you all." "Her parents," Miss Howard said coolly and quickly, "are consular officials, French consular officials. Unfortunately, they plan to return home as soon as they're reunited with the child, understandably." "Ah, yes," Mr. Roosevelt nodded, looking serious for a moment. "That is understandable, I suppose, quite understandable. But I hope you'll emphasize to them, Sarah, that this sort of incident is hardly typical of our nation." "Of course," Miss Howard answered. Grinning again as he went back to studying Anna, Mr. Roosevelt said, "Friends, you say? What a pity they weren't Spanish. She has something of a Spanish look about her, this little one. It might have been useful to show those blackguards how a free people handles a problem like this."
Yes, Mr. Moore said casually.
"It might have been."
"Still," Mr. Roosevelt went on as our boat cruised out into the center of the Hudson, "as you say, Doctor, it hardly matters who her family is. She is a child, and she is safe now." At that, Anna reached out again to clutch Mr. Roosevelt's playful finger, causing his smile to widen.
"Do you know," he said quietly, "I think a baby's hand is the most beautiful thing in the world."
Chapter 58.
Once we were all back at 17th Street, Lucius discovered that the doctor had a nursing bottle in his consulting room. He used it, what you might call ironically enough, to lecture women who were having trouble weaning their kids, and began to mix a concoction in it, what he thought might help Ana Linares get over the touch of colic, but was continuing every few minutes to take away her usual happy smile and playful laughter. Milk, honey, and a little paregoric, what was left over from my attempts to dose Cat, all went into the brew, and as the detective sergeant fed it to the baby, she did seem to regain her full color and sprightliness of spirit. It was a breath of fresh air to have a contented, even happy, symbol of new life among a group of people who'd experienced nothing but violence and killing for days and nights on end. In fact, so potent was the effect of Anna's presence that we all took turns holding and feeding her, letting the little girl's unspoiled joy at being alive and our knowledge that we'd rescued her from a close brush with death perform the kind of healing magic what only children can bring. Along toward 1 a.m., Mr. Roosevelt and Lieutenant Kimball took their leave and headed back for Washington to resume the business of planning the war with Spain, what they believed and hoped was on its way. I don't know to this day if anyone ever told the former police commissioner just how much our business that night might have been connected, if things had broken only a hair differently, to the outbreak of that war. Something tells me that he and the doctor must have had words about it before Mr. Roosevelt's death earlier this year. But the most important fact, then as now, was that Mr. Roosevelt had come to our aid without knowing anything more than that his friends and an innocent child were in trouble. It only made me like and respect the man all the more, and as I think of him now, pulling away from the house in his landau on his way to Grand Central, flashing us that wonderful grin what would one day keep political cartoonists in such clover, I wondered why it was that so few men had his kind of strength. That particular ability to be gentle and loving with a baby on the one hand, and to crack the heads of mugs like the Hudson Dusters on the other. It's a question which still dogs me. At about 1:30, the detective sergeants returned from the first precinct house down on New Street, where the body of Libby Hatch had been taken after its arrival at the police pier. From the first, the corpse would be shipped on up to the morgue, a fact what made my spirit burn. I didn't much like the idea of the murderess being in so much as the same building as Cat, even if they were both dead. Still, there was nothing to do about it, as an autopsy had to be performed on Libby. The conclusions of said procedure, we later found out, were inconclusive, just as Mr. Moore'd suspected they would be. As for El Nino, I half expected that he might telephone the house that night just to make sure everything had turned out okay, but then I realized that, so far as he was concerned, everything already had. His jefe had been avenged, and baby Anna would be returned to her mother. All that was left for him in New York was trouble with the law, and when I took the time to consider it, I realized that I'd much rather he move fast to get safely out of town, and maybe out of the country, than slow down to risk contact with us. For her part, Miss Howard had, according to plan, phoned uptown to the French consulate straightway when we returned to the doctor's house to inform Senora Linares that all was well and that, as soon as she had police protection, she'd bring Anna to her. We all knew that the detective sergeants were needed for this job and that they'd best be armed when they carried it out. There was no way of saying what new servants Señor Linares had hired when El Niño had come over to our side, or if they, like the aborigine, had been keeping watch over the doctor's house. But as it turned out, such caution wasn't necessary. Miss Howard, Marcus, and Lucius got the baby back to her mother without any sign of trouble. When they returned, they told us that the Señora was in the process of deciding whether to go back to her family in Spain or to head west to those parts of the United States where new beginnings were the common coin and where, I'd once hoped, Cat might have been able to get a fresh start on life. But the great and inexpressible joy the Señora had experienced when she'd been reunited with Anna, Miss Howard and the Isaacsons said, was enough to make such decisions seem of small importance for the moment, and had given our three teammates the powerful feeling that everything we'd been through had been well worth it. Such may have been true, too, for them. For Mr. Moore and me, though, there would always be questions. Questions about whether we'd been right in getting people we cared deeply about involved in a case what ended up costing them their lives. Such questions seldom come with easy answers, and they never go away. As I sit here writing these words, I can't say as I'm any closer to quieting those doubts than I was at 3 a.m. that morning, when everyone finally went their separate ways, and I sat for an hour in my windowsill, tearfully smoking cigarettes, and seeing cat's eyes all over the starry sky. There were, of course, the funerals to attend to, and after a simple ceremony for Cat at Calvary Cemetery on Wednesday afternoon, one which I was grateful to every member of our group for attending, we all boarded a train early Thursday morning to head back up to Ballston Spa and watch Mr. Picton get planted in the ground of the same cemetery on Ballston Avenue what we had only weeks earlier violated. It was sadness, affection, and respect, of course, what drew us so far to say our last goodbyes to the agitated little man with the ever-blasting pipe who'd refused to let the case of the murders on the Charlton Road die, and who, in death, had given us the legal leverage we'd needed to openly pursue Libby Hatch in New York. But curiosity pulled us north, too. Curiosity about what Mr. Picton's final words about a clue in the cemetery had meant. Standing by his open grave as his casket was lowered in, each of us sneaked a peek at the headstones of the other members of his family, and we were all slightly shocked to find that every person in that plot, not only Mr. Picton's parents, but a younger sister and brother as well, had died on exactly the same day. This led the doctor to put some gentle questions to Mrs. Hastings after the ceremony, which she answered by saying that indeed, Mr. Picton's family had all been killed one night as they slept by a gas leak in the big house at the end of High Street. Mr. Picton had been away at law school when it had happened, and he'd never spoken of the matter in later years. And while Mrs. Hastings wouldn't comment on the odd coincidence of gas leaking in so many rooms of the Picton house at one and the same time, she did say that it was after the tragedy that Mr. Picton had decided to pursue a career in prosecution. This was enough for the doctor, who knew, as did I think Mrs. Hastings, that the coincidence of the several gas leaks was so incredible as to be dismissible. Someone had deliberately done away with the family, and the fact that all the doors of the house had been bolted when it had happened indicated that it had been one of the Pictons themselves. Beyond that, though, neither the doctor nor anyone else could do more than speculate. Had Mr. Picton's mother, in a fit of some kind of despondency, done away with her husband, her offspring, and herself by means of gas, not an uncommon practice, according to the doctor, among lethally melancholic women? Had Mr. Picton suspected the truth about the matter, and had that suspicion not only made him endlessly anxious for the rest of his days, but driven him for so many years to convict Libby Hatch? We would never know. But just the possibility, combined with the sad occasion of the funeral itself, was enough to keep us all very quiet during the train ride back to New York. Things calmed down eerily around 17th Street in the days what immediately followed. The case was over, but there was no possibility of returning to a normal routine, being as, even if our spirits had been strong enough to bounce back so quickly, we were still waiting to find out the results of the court investigation into affairs at the Doctor's Institute. On Friday morning, the Isaacsons, who'd put off giving their testimony ever since we'd gotten back to town, finally went before the closed court and told their tale. That same afternoon, the Reverend Bancroft was called to give his opinion about how the Institute was set up, whether the staff were up to snuff, and if, in general, the place was a sound proposition. The court waited until Monday to hand down its decision, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that those 2 days were among the longest of my life. The weather turned foully humid, coating every person in the city in the kind of thin sheet of heavy sweat what seems impossible to get off and always sends tempers flaring. Monday was no better. The thermometer had already climbed into the high 80s by 10, and when Cyrus, the doctor, and I boarded the calash to head down to the Tweed Courthouse at 2, I wasn't sure that either Frederick, whose weeks of boarding had made him a touch lazy, or any of the rest of us was going to make it. But make it we did, in every sense of the word. Not only did Judge Samuel Wells surprise us by declaring that the affairs of the Institute were in order and the case of Paulie McPherson was an obvious aberration, but he went on to shock the entire courtroom by giving those city fathers what had brought on the investigation a tongue-lashing. Dr. Kreitzler's methods might be unorthodox, Judge Wells said, and some people might not be comfortable with them. In fact, he wasn't so sure that he was comfortable with all of them himself. But you couldn't argue with results, and the plain fact was that in all his years of operation, the doctor had lost exactly one kid, one who, as the detective sergeant's investigation had plainly revealed, had been at least thinking about suicide before coming to the Institute, and who'd brought the instrument of the crime with him when he was enrolled. Reminding the doctor's critics that New York's courts had better things to do than pursue unwarranted investigations, Judge Wells declared the whole matter dismissed. We'd known that Wells was an unpredictable character, but no public official had ever made that kind of statement in support of the doctor's work, and the event was enough to make you think that maybe there was some kind of justice in the world after all. Mr. Moore had taken the hopeful chance of engaging a private room at Mr. Delmonico's restaurant for after the hearing, such rooms being the only places in the joint where Cyrus and I were allowed to eat. And during the meal that followed, the adults stuffed themselves on more kinds of strangely named French food than I could possibly rattle off all these years later. As for me, I made do with a steak and fried potatoes. And Mr. Delmonico even rounded me up a bottle of root beer, though I think he had to send one of his boys out to fetch it from a local grocer. But even if I can't remember just what it was that everybody ate, I can remember that it was an evening of a type what was rare for us. There'd been no killings or kidnappings, and no great mystery was the main topic of conversation. In fact, crime didn't come up much at all. It was just a time to be happy in each other's company and remember that terrible events were not the only things that bonded us together. Being as the rest of the day had gone so well, we probably should have known that some unpleasant or at least disturbing surprise would be waiting for us at its end. The doctor invited everyone back to his house after the meal at Delmonico's, and when we arrived, we discovered a very handsome brougham sitting at the curb in front of the front yard. But the two men sitting up on the driving seat didn't exactly match the rig. Wearing rough sailor's jackets, what indicated a familiarity with the seamier parts of the waterfront, they had the kind of deep brown features, thin, drooping mustaches, and large, dark eyes, what immediately suggested they were from India or that general part of the world. I was riding in a cab with Detective Sergeant Lucius, whose face, always jolly and rosy after a big meal and lots of red wine at Mr. Delmonico's, suddenly went straight, even a little pale, when he saw the carriage and the men. "What the—" he whispered. "Oh, no." "Oh, no?" I answered, looking at the brougham and then back at the detective sergeant. "What's oh, no about it? Who are they?" Taking a deep breath, Lucius said, "They look like Lascars." "Lascars?" I repeated, now a little disturbed myself. Even I knew about the tough breed of sailors and pirates whose home waters were the Indian Ocean and the South China Sea. "What the hell are they doing here?" "Care to guess?" the detective sergeant said. "Lascars are a very common sight on the Manila waterfront." "Oh," I noised, glancing again at the two mugs and the brougham. Then I just sank down into my seat. "Ah, shit." By the time Lucius's and my cab stopped, the others had already gotten out of a second hansom and the doctor's calash and were gathered around the door of the brougham. There was no sign of life from inside the thing yet, and the first such that we got was a question. "Dr. Kreitzler," said a deep voice, one what bore a strong Spanish accent. The doctor stepped forward. "I am Dr. Laszlo Kreitzler. May I be of assistance?" The door of the brougham finally opened, and out stepped a very dark, handsome man of medium height and build, his hair carefully fixed with pomade.
His clothes looked to be about the best that money could buy, and had that formal cut what seems to always mark the diplomat. In his hand he carried a walking stick, which had a heavy ball of silver for a handle.
"I am Señor Narciso Linares. I believe you know of me."
The doctor just nodded with a small smile, having already guessed, like the rest of us, who the caller was. "Señor?" Señor Linares flicked his stick toward the house.
"Is there a place where we may speak? The matter is most urgent."
"Please," the doctor said, indicating the front door. The señor moved toward it, and the doctor followed, after which the rest of us moved to do the same, but then the two Lascars jumped down off the brougham and stood in our way at the gate to the front yard, folding their arms and seeming ready for an argument. The doctor turned around, an expression of shock coming into his face. "Señor," he said very sternly, "what is the meaning of this behavior? These people are residents of and guests in this house." Considering the matter for a moment, the señor just nodded and said, "So." Then he mouthed some words in Spanish to the Lascars, who glumly moved back toward the carriage. After that we all went inside, Cyrus keeping a very careful eye on the two boys at the curb as we did. The doctor led Señor Linares up into the parlor and offered him a drink. When the visitor requested a glass of brandy, Mr. Moore fetched it, while the rest of us took seats. Cyrus stood by one window and opened it, still watching the Lascars. "Dr. Kreitzler," Señor Linares said in some surprise when he saw that we all intended on staying in the parlor, "my business with you is of a private nature. It is certainly not for the ears of servants." "There are no servants here," the doctor replied. "These are my colleagues." The señor glanced at Cyrus. "The black as well?" Trying hard not to get openly irritated, the doctor just said, "If you have something you wish to discuss, señor, you must do so in front of our collected company. Otherwise, I must bid you good evening." Shrugging, Señor Linares drained his brandy and put the glass aside. "I shall come to the point, then. I have reason to believe, doctor, that you know the whereabouts of my wife and child."
"Indeed?"
"Yes. If this is so, I most strongly recommend that you reveal those whereabouts to me unless you wish to provoke a diplomatic incident." The doctor paused and took out his cigarette case. "I had always understood that diplomats were tactful men," he said. "Perhaps I was misinformed." "The time for tact is long past," Señor Linares answered testily. "I know that some time ago. My wife sought the assistance of this woman." He waved his stick in Miss Howard's general direction. "Since then, my life has been a succession of difficulties. I warn you, sir, I am most sincere in my threat of an official protest." As he lit one of his smokes, the doctor studied the señor for a few more seconds, then sat back. "Actually, you are not." Señor Linares looked like he'd been slapped. "You call me a liar?" he demanded, getting to his feet.
"Please, sir," the doctor replied, waving his cigarette and not at all concerned. "Spare me your Latin pride. Or what is the term that men such as yourself use, your machismo? It is wasted here, I assure you."
"Dr. Kreitzler," the señor answered, "I am not a man to endure such words."
"Señor Linares," the doctor said, "please do sit down. I submit that if you had any intention of actually involving either your consulate or your government in this matter, you would have done so long ago, and you would certainly not have arrived at my house in the company of such creatures as those two men."
He threw a hand lightly in the direction of the window, "whose presence was undoubtedly intended to extract, through physical intimidation, the information you seek. Fortunately for myself, less fortunately for you, I did not return home alone. Shall we dispense, then, with talk of diplomatic incidents?" The señor gave himself a couple of seconds, then sat back down and even managed a small, what you might call, begrudging smile.
"Yes, I heard that you were a clever man."
The doctor's voice suddenly went hard.
And I have heard that you, sir, are a man who does not shrink from beating women, as well as anyone else who might be smaller and weaker than yourself. And that you have been perfectly willing, anxious even, to conceal the abduction of your own child. So, perhaps you can tell me, senor, why is it that you come here now, as if you were the governor of some far-off Spanish colony, in an attempt to bully me into giving you information that I do not possess?
The senor looked up quickly.
Then, you do not know what has become of my wife and daughter? If I knew, sir, I should hardly be likely to tell you. But you have my word that I do not.
Which was true. Señora Linares had left New York over the weekend, but hadn't made her final destination known to Miss Howard before going. She planned to write when she was resettled and all was well. Taking the doctor's statement, it seemed to me, more lightly than a man in his position might have been expected to, Señor Linares rested himself against his stick and said,
"I see. So, it seems that I have wasted my time coming here."
Then he glanced up at Mr. Moore, almost like he was annoyed that he hadn't been given another brandy yet. Pouring it for him, Mr. Moore couldn't help but get into the action.
"Was it just because she was a girl? They don't count for much in your part of the world, do they, female offspring?"
The senor shook his head.
"You Americans, such provincial moralists. Do you imagine I would conduct myself as I have without compelling reasons?"
"What reasons," Miss Howard asked, quietly but what you might call disdainfully, "could possibly be compelling enough to make you abandon Anna?" Glancing around the room at each of our faces, Señor Linares downed his second brandy, then began to nod his head slowly.
"I suppose my motives must seem horrifying to your rather naive way of thinking."
"We're not sure what your motives are," Marcus offered.
"We've been trying to determine that since the beginning," Lucius added, "without success." Still nodding as Mr. Moore poured him yet another shot of brandy, Señor Linares said,
"I can understand the difficulty. You, like the rest of your countrymen, believe what is in your newspapers. The Spanish Empire is a decadent collection of arrogant militarists who would like nothing better than to prove their virility against whatever nation offends them. Well," he took a smaller sip of brandy, "you are right, in part, but only in part."
Indicating the doctor's silver cigarette box, the senor said,
"May I?"
To which the doctor, now very interested in what the man was saying, nodded. The senor lit up one of the number inside the box, drew on it, and let the smoke out with a look of satisfaction.
"Very fine," he said.
"Russian?" The doctor nodded again.
"Georgian, blended with Virginia."
The senor took another drag.
"Yes, very fine indeed. Tell me, doctor, have you ever heard of a cousin of mine, General Arsenio Linares?"
The doctor shook his head.
"He commands at Santiago de Cuba, or of Admiral Pascual Cervera y Topete, commander of our naval squadron at Cadiz."
Again the doctor came up blank.
"I did not think so. But you know, you all know, of the butcher, General Wheeler, and of the belligerent clique of monarchists and military officers that surround the Queen Regent. They are the men who are quoted in your newspapers, your Mr. Hearst and Mr. Pulitzer. They will not sell their product by printing Voices of Reason."
"Reason?" the doctor asked, looking puzzled. The senor gave him a tough, straight look.
"You don't really suppose, doctor, that we are all so blind as to be unable to recognize the reality which surrounds us. Yes, there are many Spaniards in Cuba, and in Spain, and even in my boyhood home of the Philippines, who believe that your country has meddled in our affairs and insulted our leaders past the point of toleration. And they are right. But they wish to resolve the matter through war. They wish it almost as much as do many Americans. There are those in our country, however, who know what the inevitable result of such a war would be. The men I have mentioned, for example, know, and I know."
"Would you mind telling us?" Mr. Moore said.
Señor Linares looked over at him and chuckled.
"This country, it is like a youth who has suddenly grown into manhood and does not yet realize the extent of his own strength. If Spain goes to war with your country, senor, the result will be disastrous for our empire. We will lose what little we still possess in this hemisphere, and probably a great deal more. But such arguments are lost on those who wish to defend our pride with arms. They pay no attention to the warnings of experienced officers like my cousin or Admiral Cervera, who know how great our weakness is. Nor do they listen to mere consular secretaries who have seen your great ships under construction in Brooklyn, in Newport, and in Virginia. Staring into his glass, Señor Linares seemed to grow bitterly downcast. They do not listen. The doctor's eyes had gone wide. Are you saying, he asked quietly, that you deliberately tried to suppress knowledge of your daughter's abduction in order to keep political extremists in your country from obtaining further rationalizations for declaring war on the United States? Looking not at all ashamed of it, the señor answered, What would you have done, doctor? The Spanish Empire is sick, dying of its own arrogance, which seeks any excuse to be unleashed. I know this. Yet at the same time I was raised to be a part of that empire. My family has served it for 300 years. I must do all that I can to hold off the final destruction. Including letting your own daughter quite possibly die? Miss Howard said. Señor Linares didn't look at her as he answered. Spain needs sons, not daughters. The cost had to be weighed against the return, as you Americans say. So now, Marcus went on for him, you're just trying to make sure that they won't resurface somewhere. You want to be certain the matter is really ended. The señor shrugged. I should like an annulment from my wife, if she will not return to me. I shall marry again. As I say, Spain needs sons. Suddenly standing up, his eyes burning, the doctor said, I have told you that we know nothing of the whereabouts of your family, Señor Linares. That is the truth. And now I must ask that you leave my house. The señor didn't look like the fairly rude order came as much of a surprise. He got up, leaning on his stick, then nodded, and walked into the hall. Señor, Miss Howard called after him. The man stopped at the top of the staircase and turned. If a man can place a greater priority on his country than his own child, and if his country not only tolerates but encourages such a choice, then hasn't that country already been destroyed? In the months to come, Señor Linares answered quietly, I suspect that we shall learn the answer to that question. Stepping quickly, almost lightly, the señor made his way out of the house and back to his carriage, leaving the rest of us to sit quietly and think over this, the last missing piece, in the case of Libby Hatch. Chapter 59. Of course, war between the United States and the Empire of Spain did come, just months after we sat in the doctor's parlor with Señor Linares. And in spite of what a lot of people seem to have taken to believing since, what the señor had called Spanish arrogance was just as responsible for the bloodbath as were all the rantings and ravings of those Americans who had favored the idea. Señor Linares's predictions about the outcome of the thing proved just as accurate as his ideas about its causes. The Spanish Empire was pretty well destroyed, and the United States found itself in possession of a whole string of new foreign possessions, including the Philippine Islands. I don't guess that much of anybody, even in Washington, had a really sound idea of what they were getting themselves into by taking over such places. As Mr. Finley P. Dunn, the newspaper wag, wrote at the time, most Americans couldn't have told you whether the Philippines were islands or canned goods before the war. As for me, I had only one thought, a question really, when I heard that we were the new rulers of the place. Had El Niño returned to his homeland before we invaded, and had he then become part of the native army, what quickly began to fight against our country for independence?
I never found out, but it would have been like him. The detective sergeants returned to their regular duties at the police department after they'd finished their investigation of the doctor's institute, but their position there remained as troubled as it had always been. Over the years, there have been commissions what have investigated corruption in the department. In fact, it sometimes seems like there's always a commission investigating said corruption. And Marcus and Lucius have given testimony before all of them in an attempt to get at least the Bureau of Detectives cleaned up. But the only real result of their efforts has been to isolate them even more from their peers, and I'm sure that if it wasn't for the brilliance what they've demonstrated on so many cases, they would have gotten the axe a long time ago. But they keep on going, squabbling, experimenting, and generally trying to use forensic science to push police work forward. And many's the thief, killer, rapist, and mad bomber what wishes that the Irish brass had been able to get rid of the Jew boys a long time ago. Miss Howard kept her operation at number 808 Broadway going after the Hatch case. In fact, she and it are still going, though she eventually expanded its services so that both men and women could gain the benefit of her skills. Over time, she's gotten to be kind of a legend in the detection world, a fact what makes her very proud, though she'd never admit as much. And despite all her talk about men's defects, she's actually taken the time to get herself mixed up with one or two of them along the way, though it's not for me to reveal the details of those experiences. What I can say is that she remains the most singular woman I've ever come across, always displaying a combination of deep friendship and independence, what many members of her sex are as incapable of achieving today as Libby Hatch was 22 years ago. I guess that this situation exists, as Miss Howard has always maintained, because of all the guff that women are fed as young girls. And maybe the solution is for more females to carry guns. I don't know. Miss Howard's certainly put quite a few more bullets into men's legs over the years, and it's only helped her stay her own person. Cyrus's and my friendship, well, that's always been one of the rocks of my life. He got married, not too long after the business of Libby Hatch was completed, and his wife, Merle Spotswood, came to live with us, ending our long search to find a decent cook. She was and remains one of the best ever born, besides being as personally decent and strong as her husband. I was still living in the doctor's house when their three kids came into the world, and though they turned the top floor of the place into a noisy nursery, the young ones moved into the room what had once belonged to Mary Palmer. I didn't mind. It did sometimes drive the doctor a little crazy, but the kids always made sure to walk softly when they passed by his study door, and having children around the house did a lot of good for everyone's spirits. 17th Street was a happy place during those years, one what I was not a little sorry to leave when it came time for me to move out into the back room of my store and start life on my own. As for the doctor, once his name had been cleared, he dived back into affairs at his institute like a man what had been deprived of life's necessities. That's not to say that there weren't questions raised during that spring and summer of 1897 what stayed with him. There certainly were. Some of them, what had driven Paulie McPherson to hang himself? What had actually happened to Mr. Picton's family? How many children had Libby Hatch killed that we didn't even know about? Were unanswerable and faded with the years. But others were more personal and didn't go anywhere. In fact, they seem to occupy the doctor still, at times, as he sits in his parlor of a late night and ponders the complications of life. You couldn't say that those questions were put into his head by the clever Clarence Darrow, exactly, for the doctor had always vexed himself with nagging doubts. But Mr. Darrow's skilled statement of those doubts during Libby Hatch's trial gave voice to what might otherwise have stayed unspoken ideas. Most of all, the question of why the doctor had and has always worked so hard to find explanations for the terrible events he's encountered in his professional life seems to have been tough for him to come to grips with. Mr. Darrow's suggestion that maybe he was at heart using his work as a way of quieting the doubts what he had about himself obviously struck a deep chord,
And as the doctor watched his one-time opponent go on to great fame in courtrooms all across America, I think the idea only haunted him all the more. But it never stopped him from working, from pressing ahead, and it's that ability to work through the self-doubts what any worthwhile human being feels. That is, so far as I can tell, the only thing what separates a meaningful life from a useless one.